Ski, Shoot, Repeat, a biathlon podcast, hosted by Lizzie Boyle. Episode 31. Forget about it. In his book, Lethe, The Art and Critique of Forgetting, the German philosopher Harald Weinrich wrote, "Everyone is forgetful. We have all had the experience of forgetting something every now and then, and even of totally forgetting many things we learned with great effort. Thus, no one can blithely say, 'That is unforgettable, I shall never forget that.' Man is, by nature, a forgetful being. Recognition of our own or others' forgetfulness is among everyone's elementary experiences of life and a plague of old age. Hence, there is no need to provide a didactic definition of the word forget. We all already know what this word means, and it is the thing we are least likely to forget." I love that quote because it recognizes that forgetting something is natural and human. It's not a sign of weakness. It's just something that we all do. I also love that quote because it gives me cover for the fact that I completely forgot something in my end-of-year roundup in episode 30. So this episode will feature some analysis on memory and forgetting. Why is it that we remember some things but forget others? And it will act as my apology to Germany because I didn't mention them at all last time round, and they deserve some time in the spotlight for their achievements and endeavours in the Biathlon World Cup and World Championships of 2023 and 24. Friedrich Nietzsche once said, "The advantage of a bad memory is that one enjoys several times the same good things for the first time." So I hope you enjoy this episode for the first time, and a reminder of Germany's 2023-24 season. And if you enjoy something, you're more likely to remember it, aren't you? So let's start by asking the big question. Why do we remember some things and forget others? Memory is the process by which we take inputs, things we see, smell, hear, experience, and convert them into something stored that we can recall when we need to. A lot of this happens unconsciously, every day. At a basic level, I can type the notes for this podcast because I remember how to move my fingers. I can type quickly because I remember without thinking where the keys are on my keyboard. Put me on a German keyboard, for example, with a different layout of keys, and my unconscious memory of a keyboard's layout is no use. I have to consciously look at the keyboard, and that disrupts me. Alongside this instinctive remembering, there is also short-term memory and long-term memory. Short-term is remembering what you did yesterday evening, if you can. Long-term is remembering your last day at school or your first kiss. Researchers from UC Irvine describe newly formed memories as like unset concrete, vulnerable for a few hours. The brain can erase them during that crucial early period. But there's more to it than short-term and long-term memory. There are layers of memory that affect what and how we remember. When we're young, we learn concepts through examples. Mum, dad, cat, dog. Someone points to a thing, tells us what it's called, and repeats it until we associate the sound with the thing, even if we don't really understand what the concept is. It gets us started. We then remember categories of things. If you're about to cross a busy road, someone might shout, "Look out for that car!" You remember the category of car, recognize a car-like thing coming towards you, and hopefully get out of the way. You don't necessarily stop to identify the make and model of car. It's enough to identify and remember the category, along with a memory that cars hurt when they hit you, to take action. That action happens so quickly, it's almost instinctive. It's in a part of the brain called the striatum, and it's part of our fight or flight response. If someone shouts duck, you instinctively duck. You don't think they're pointing to a water bird. Senses and emotions get processed into memories in the amygdala. I'll talk about the role of emotions more in a minute, but basically your emotional and sensory perceptions get processed in the amygdala and get stored. That's why a smell can evoke a memory, for example, or why you can answer the question, when were you happiest? The even more sophisticated work happens in the hippocampus. That's where we get a sense of the passage of time. How long is it since we last watched biathlon together? It's also where we store memories of having been in a place or done a certain thing. And it's where we create expectation or anticipation. If someone says, remember the World Cup in Novo Mesto, as you start to remember, you'll have certain expectations. What it will look like, what the weather was like, who won some of the races. Your memory generally conforms to those expectations. If it doesn't, you'll feel a kind of wariness. You'll pause. If you meet someone you know, you bring back memory of who they are, but you'll get taken by surprise if they speak a new language to you, for example. We talk about left brain and right brain, but really it's about front brain and back brain. Front is all about movement. Back is about senses and perception. Where humans are special is in the number of channels connecting front to back. So now you can walk to the shop, or you can imagine walking to the shop, because your movement brain and your sense brain can collectively imagine it together. There are three stages to memory: encoding, storage, and retrieval. Just a quick note on the language. Encoding, storage, and retrieval sound like computer language, and it's tempting to see the brain as a computer or a library, but it's not that simple. There are multiple active processes when we create memories and when we reconstruct them. They don't just come back out of your brain fully formed. We know it's an active process because it's not just the memory part of your brain that activates when you go looking for an old memory. It's the emotional bit, the bit that helps you decode the memory in the first place. Anyway, when we're encoding memories, there are three things that really make them stick: attention, emotion, and the element of surprise. There's a lot of talk about attention these days, often to do with the reduction in attention span based on our dopamine-hit smartphone obsessions. Anyone who's watched a biathlon sprint all the way till the last athlete finishes is fine as far as attention span is concerned. The thing is, we only have a finite amount of attention that we can give at any one moment. Whilst we're all watching biathlon, we're also posting, scrolling, researching and commenting on it, and we can't pay attention to everything. Neuroscientist Lisa Genova says that we tend to pay attention to, and therefore remember, what we find interesting, meaningful, new, surprising, significant, emotional, and consequential. Our brains capture those details. We ignore and fail to remember the rest. Paying attention doesn't just happen, though. It's a conscious activity. Left to its own devices, your brain will daydream and meander. If you've ever tried to meditate, you'll know that the first few minutes are spent witnessing your brain running around like a chaotic child. If you want to remember something, you have to turn your brain on and become consciously aware of it. That's easier if it's something that has emotional intensity for you. If you're a fan of a specific biathlete, you'll remember where they finished in the race. If you're a fan of a national team, you'll remember the goals they scored. It's also easier to pay attention to things that are surprising, which is why Estonia coming fourth in a biathlon relay is way more memorable than Germany doing the same thing. Elizabeth Kensinger of Boston College explains the link between attention and not remembering. There's a trade-off that happens when something grabs your attention. It leaves less mental resource for remembering anything else. She calls this an attention magnet, something that takes your mental and emotional effort. Her research gives the example of crime scenes, where witnesses focus on the horrific thing in front of them and don't remember much about the street scene or the background to it. She also suggests that you can train yourself, effectively by instructing yourself to remember everything about a scene or image, or saying to yourself that you need to remember a scene so you could instruct an artist to draw the whole thing. That way, you shift your attention away from the particular into the wider scene around it. On to emotion. An article in Psychology Today tells us that memory formation involves registering information, processing and storage, and retrieval. Emotion acts like a highlighter pen that emphasizes certain aspects of experiences to make them more memorable. Often this highlighter pen effect of emotion is connected to big events, episodic or emotional memories. These might be major life events like weddings, but could also be what Kensinger calls flashbulb memories, like disasters, assassinations or terrorist attacks. You can think of these memories as like an engraving, a long-standing, if not permanent, etching into your mind, based on the intensity of emotion that you felt at the time, and the hormonal rush you got from it. You can think of short-term memories more like a post-it note where you've written a reminder. You can't store much information on a post-it note, and there's a likelihood that it'll just get thrown away. I mentioned hormones because there's a physiological response to heightened emotions. Dopamine, epinephrine, and glucose are emitted when we are highly emotional and activated, and this helps with the encoding and processing of information into our memories. These same areas of the brain also activate when we're retrieving those memories. Hence the filing cabinet analogy isn't enough in itself. Not all emotions are the same though. Often, high emotions can narrow your memory. You'll remember some aspects of the emotional event very well, whether emotions are positive or negative. Again, attention comes into play here. The example of the crime scene, you'll remember the crime scene element because it grabs your attention with strong negative emotions, and you'll forget the street in the background. If you saw the same street scene a few minutes before the incident, you would have a much stronger recall of the background of the street itself. Strong emotion narrows down what you remember. A couple of other things about encoding memories. If you're too stressed or too relaxed, you'll blank things out. There's a thing called the Yerkes-Dodson law, which says that you'll remember things best when you're a little bit stressed or activated. So when you're engaged with something, rather than disengaged or overstressed. And there's also something called the peak-end rule. If we're experiencing something that lasts for a period of time, we don't remember it all. We remember the peaks, whether they're high or low, and we remember the ending. This is every sporting event ever. We can recall Julia or Johannes epically fast shooting, and we can recall sprint finishes, but we don't necessarily recall something that's steady, stable, or in the middle. The third element of memory is the element of surprise. It's not surprising that things that are surprising stay with us. Underdog stories resonate, not just because of the human drama contained in them, but because they're memorable, because they're unusual. A bizarre encounter lasts longer in the mind than a routine one. If you're out tomorrow and you see someone walking their dog, you probably won't remember it. But if you see someone walking a sheep or a pig, that's more likely to stick with you. Psychologically speaking, we also read too much into the unexpected. There's a lot of research which suggests we're very bad at calculating the odds of something, in part because we think weird stuff is more likely to happen than it really is. But the surprises stay with us, good or bad. After encoding, there's storage of our memories. And then there's retrieval, where the fun starts again. We all think that we remember things accurately, but there's plenty of evidence from psychology and criminology that we are terrible eyewitnesses. As Proust said, remembrance of things past is not necessarily the remembrance of things as they were. We have many reasons to be inaccurate, some conscious, but mostly unconscious. The writer Margaret Atwood says, when we think of the past, it's the beautiful things we pick out. We want to believe it was all like that. Unfortunately, our memories are stronger for negatives than for positives, possibly based on a risk management strategy from our ancestors. In a sporting context, a lot of athletes have to work hard in mental conditioning to focus on the four shots that they hit and not the one that they missed. If you're in a negative mood, you're more likely to focus on the specific details of an incident. It's a bizarre thing. The more emotionally positive you feel about something, the more secure you feel about your memories of it. It's definitely how it happened. But actually, the more likely you are to A, be wrong, and B, to accept false memories from others. By contrast, the more emotionally negative you feel about something, the more accurate your memory will be, but only on certain details, not seeing the bigger picture. And if you're emotionally neutral, well, you probably didn't remember it in the first place. The other thing about retrieving our memories is that they seem to change over time. We're convinced that we're being consistent, but we're not, unless we practice telling the same story over and over again. Mood plays a part. When we're happy, we tend to remember happy things, and when we're sad, the opposite. And as we get older, the brain draws similarities across events and memories rather than trying to hold on to each individual thing. This means that we do forget a few things, but it also means that we recognise themes and connections much more. This might be the neurological basis for the idea of wisdom coming with age. So how to remember? Well, unless you want to live in a heightened state of attention and emotion and be constantly surprised, you're going to forget some things. And that's not actually a bad thing. If you remembered everything, you'd be stuck sifting through it all every time you tried to look back at the past or make a plan for the future. Researchers at Harvard suggested that if you really want to remember, you need to focus your attention, concentrate on organising the information, try to understand the information, and relate it to something that your brain already knows. They also recommend eating well, exercising, keeping your brain stimulated, staying socially active, and sleeping well, which sounds like sensible advice to me. So having explained how we remember and justified that it's okay to forget, let's look back on Germany's season to see if we can understand why I forgot it. The first thing to say is that the start of the season was incredibly memorable. It had our attention and it took us by surprise. That first week in Östersund was all about Germany. Franziska Preuß and Vanessa Voigt took second and third in the women's individual, Preuß missing out on the win by just 0.1 of a second. Sophia Schneider came fifth too. Preuß and Voigt kept the form going, coming fourth and fifth in the sprint, which doesn't always suit them, and rising to second and third in the pursuit. Roman Rees took the men's individual in Östersund, from Justus Strello in second, with Benny Doll in ninth. And then Philipp Nauerath won the men's sprint, shooting 10 out of 10 and finishing 18 seconds ahead of Tarje Bo, who shot the same. Nauerath also held on for second in the pursuit. Honestly, I have read and reread that several times, and it feels unbelievable. There was a lot of discussion that the German wax technicians had absolutely nailed it for Östersund, but even so, those results were astonishing, surprising, and dare I say, memorable. On to Hochfilzen, with rich expectations and poor conditions. There was no joy for the women, I'm wondering if there was illness but I can't remember, whilst Doll and Johannes Kuhn found the top 10 in the men's sprint, and Doll held on for 10th in the pursuit. Then to Lenzerheide, the women returned. Preuß was 7th in the sprint, moving up to 4th in the pursuit, and 7th in the mass start too. And both Voigt and Hettich-Waltz turned in great pursuit performances to finish in the top 10. The men bounced back at Lenzerheide too. Doll won the sprint with Nauerath 3rd, Horn 4th, and Kuhn 6th. Four Germans in the top 10 in a sprint sounds insane. Why don't I remember that one? Horn, Kuhn, and Strelo managed to make the top 10 in the pursuit after a Norwegian resurgent, something which happened a lot this season, and which meant that our attention, that word again, was very much on the Norwegians at the end of races rather than anyone else. David Zirbel came from nowhere to be 7th in the men's mass start. This is where we start to see the story of the season. You'll note that I'm saying a lot of different names, which should make things memorable, but has perhaps made things a bit jumbled. It was sometimes hard to know where to look. More on this later, but let's carry on to Oberhof. There was more great form for the men, with Benny Doll winning another sprint and Kuhn picking up a 5th and an 8th, and for the women with Preuß 2nd and Hettich-Waltz 5th in the sprint. The story continued in Ruhpolding. Hettich-Waltz and Preuß both in top 10 in the sprint, Preuß staying up there in the pursuit, and this time it was just Estrello on the men's side, 6th in the sprint and 5th in the pursuit, based off some phenomenal shooting. Things get confusing again as we go to Antholz. This time it's Kuhn getting 3rd, and a new name, Danilo Riethmüller, 7th in the individual, with Roman Rees 10th. Estrello gets a 9th in the mass start. What's going on? Why can't the same guy be near the top each time? The women are consistent though, with Voigt, Hettich-Waltz and Preuß, all in the top 10 in the individual, and Voigt getting 4th in the mass start. To this point, we're seeing multiple top tens from people across both the men's and women's squads. It's actually turning out to be a solid season. Perhaps the men's results have been flattered by poor form from the French men's team. And at Novo Mesto, this certainly looked the case. Benny Doll picked up a great bronze in the individual. But Nowrath in the sprint was the only other German man to make a top 10. The women's individual was a high point, with Hettich-Waltz, Grosjean and Voigt all in the top 5. And then something happens. The results stop being across every race and start to be in just one race. The men's mass start in Oslo is great, with 3 in the top 10, including a second place for Doll. But that's all. Voigt manages 6th in the women's individual, but there's nothing else. By Soldier Hollow it's even sparser, with only Johannes Kuhn making a top 10 at all, and with Preuss not travelling to North America. And we ended the season in Canmore, where Janina Hettich-Waltz had a career weekend, with 3 top 10s, including a 2nd in the mass start. And Kuhn and Riethmüller both made the sprint top 10. There's a lot of numbers in that recap, which you'll probably forget. But having looked at those numbers, I can honestly say that I remember Benny Doll winning one of those sprint races by outskiing Johannes Tingesbo on the final lap. Perhaps a surprise. Preuss just missing a win in Östersund. Hettich-Waltz ending the season brilliantly. And Riethmüller coming from nowhere. So why do I remember that, but not the rest? Why don't I remember poor old Just Estrello, who just had the best shooting season of almost anyone in the World Cup field? Perhaps the difficulty was that the German squad did so well that first weekend in Östersund. We remember that because it was bizarre or surprising, when we all expected other teams to dominate. It was always going to be hard to sustain that, as other teams managed melting snow conditions more effectively or had more speed. Extra pressure from home crowds in Germany and travelling fans in Austria and Switzerland probably didn't help. Illness and injury played a part. That's why it was so delightful to see Hettich-Waltz and Grosjean performing well in Novo Mesto, and to watch Hettich-Waltz really thriving at the end of the season. The peak end rule from our exploration of memory tells us that Hettich-Waltz and Riethmüller are the names we'll remember from the year, because of the timing of their peaks late in the season, and our memory for the ends of things rather than the beginnings. They both did really well in North America. The peak end rule is another reason why Preuss's second place in Östersund sticks out. That race ending was phenomenal. Thinking on some other aspects of memory, attention. Well, perhaps I just didn't pay attention because there were so many other things to pay attention to. We had the incredible depth of the French women's team, and the unpredictability of which Norwegian man would win in any given week. Dalilo Riethmüller did draw our attention. By having a late start in sprint races, you get a lot of attention and TV time, so we paid a lot of attention to him and to Botten, and they definitely justified it. What about surprise? Well, it was not surprising when Strello, Voigt and Preuss shot well. It's what they do. It was surprising when Preuss was also fast. We're not necessarily used to that from her, and we had no form from last year to compare it to. So she grabbed our attention and surprised us early on. But then other surprises came along and took over. And for all that they weren't the favourites to win, Germany also weren't the pure underdogs. They weren't Latvia or Estonia, Slovenia or Finland. As to emotion, this might be the crux of it. It's a personal thing, but I have a strong fandom of the French team. My emotional highs and lows are often associated with their performance, and perhaps that colours my memory of each race. Throw in some underdog surprises from small nations, and the sheer amount of information that needs to be processed, and for some reason it's the German team that failed to capture my attention. But here's the thing. If you bundled all of the German biathletes together, you'd have a stellar season. Preuss gave us some amazing highlights, but became less consistent and struggled with illness, and then didn't travel to North America. She still shot 93% in the prone and 86% in the stand, and finished 11th in the overall World Cup. And this was a great return after missing time last season. If she can stay healthy for a full season, she can be up there, perhaps competing for a top 5 position. Vanessa Voigt left it all on the range, 96% prone and 91% standing. But her lack of ski speed leaves her in the teens after sprint races, and always playing catch-up in the pursuits. She only needs to gain a little more speed to be really competitive in the longer format races. Janina started slowly, but blossomed in the new year, got a medal at the World Championships, and seems to have become aware that she's really good at this. She too was shooting 93% in the prone, and her 80% standing shoot shows a clear area for focus for the off-season. New talent like Selena Groshon, Johanna Puff, and Julia Kink show that the future is bright. But the German issue has never been one about bringing forward junior athletes. It feels like it's more about sustaining them once they get to the highest level and avoiding physical and mental burnout. On the men's side, Doll was a sprint god, but tended to struggle in the 20-shot races, where the Norwegians were super strong. You could almost guarantee another German man in the top 10 alongside Doll, but it was never the same guy. We got excited about Roman Rees, and then he was replaced by Naurath, and then by Kuhn, and then by Riethmüller. There didn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to it. Strello was an incredible marksman all year, shooting 95% prone and 93% standing. He's 28 years old, so he's coming into the prime period for male biathletes and is definitely one to watch. Rees, Naurath, Kuhn, and the emerging Riethmüller have all shown that they have the skill set to get into the top 10, so now it's about consistency. And that might come down more to management than to the athletes. How can you plan out a whole season and get some of these guys more regularly into the top rankings? I'm even allowing for the fact that Norway tended to have 3 to 5 people in the top 10, so there's not much space in there. The foundations are there, the infrastructure, the support. The skills and talent are there. Now it's just about finding that sprinkling of magic in advance of next season. And next year, I'll definitely pay more attention. One last thing. Combining our two themes this week, memory and Germany, leads me to Hermann Ebbinghaus, a psychologist working in the late 19th and early 20th century, who was interested in how we learn and how we remember. He was the first to theorise what we now call the learning curve or experience curve, which says that the more you perform a task, the better you are at doing it. Ebbinghaus was also interested in what he called the forgetting curve. That's the rate at which we forget things over time if we don't make an effort to remember them. His experiment was to learn random sets of 3 letters, D-A-X, Q-O-F, that sort of thing, and then see how long you could remember them for if you didn't take steps to actively remember. Broadly, he found out that our memory of something halves over a matter of days if we don't try to consciously remember it. More importantly, Ebbinghaus was one of the pioneers of experimental psychology, and using an arbitrary and meaningless set of symbols as a thing to remember, rather than an object which might have strong associations for someone, has become a standard practice in a lot of psychological experiments these days. A nice quote from Ebbinghaus to end with. No matter how thoroughly a person may have learned the Greek alphabet, he will never be in a condition to repeat it backwards without further training. The schoolboy doesn't force himself to learn his vocabularies and rules altogether at night, but he knows he must impress them again in the morning. Which basically means, if I want to remember more of the biathlon season next year, I'll have to watch all the races twice. Thank you for listening to Ski Shoot Repeat. You can find a transcript of this episode and links to all sorts of background information and sources at skishootrepeat.podbean.com. Please do follow along on social media at skishootrepeat, and do get in touch to tell me what's right and what's wrong. This podcast is built more on love than on knowledge, so I do expect to get fact-checked. Let me know what you'd like to hear about in future episodes. I'll be back soon with our first biathlon backstory of the off-season, where we watch an old biathlon race, comment on the athletes, the competition, and the zeitgeist of the time. Thank you for listening to Ski Shoot Repeat. I've been Lizzie Boyle.